Usually when you clear a blocked drain, you just push harder. But if that blockage is, you know, a live explosive, pushing is the last thing you want to do.
Right, yeah.
Today's material is a transcript and study guide for the marriage course, which explores how couples can manage anger through this three-step process of discussing hurt, apologizing, and forgiving.
And let's just dive straight into how we can elevate this material, because while the underlying framework here is highly accessible and it offers a really practical mechanism for couples to clear out everyday marital friction, our goal today is to examine how to make this advice robust, psychologically safe, and, you know, culturally nuanced for all readers.
Definitely. And I do want to say right up front, it does a fantastic job of neutralizing the shame around conflict.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, framing anger as having a God-given purpose, and those rhino and hedgehog archetypes, they are incredibly accessible, positive ways to just start these conversations.
I completely agree. And that positive framing of, you know, taking the initiative to clear the drain is a massive strength.
Yeah.
It gives couples permission to say, hey, we have friction and that's okay, let's clear the drain. But while this works wonderfully for good faith, safe relationships, navigating just typical daily frustrations, we really have to look closely at what happens when that drain isn't just blocked by dead leaves, but by something far more toxic.
Right. So the curriculum's universal prescription for radical vulnerability lacks vital guardrails for relationships characterized by systemic coercion, abuse, or deeply entrenched high-conflict patterns.
Exactly. And this is where we run into a major structural weakness in the source material. I mean, the curriculum repeatedly instructs partners to take the immediate initiative to bring their hurts into the open.
Right. It leans heavily on that Matthew 5 analogy, right?
Exactly. The idea that if you are at the altar and remember your partner has a grievance, you drop everything and go make it right. It even provides a specific journaling exercise where couples, you know, sit down, write out all their unresolved hurts, and then just hand those journals over to each other.
Which, I mean, sounds wonderful on paper.
It does.
Like, if I'm in a healthy dynamic, exchanging journals is this beautiful exercise in mutual transparency. It builds intimacy. But I want to push back on the universal application here, because my immediate thought is, isn't taking a leap of faith and being vulnerable exactly what breaks a deadlock? Like, if someone doesn't take that first step, aren't they just stonewalling?
Well, a leap of faith requires a landing pad, right? And that is exactly the assumption this material is making. It assumes this baseline of emotional safety, mutual goodwill, and, you know, a relatively balanced power dynamic.
Okay, yeah.
It assumes both people are operating in good faith. But the reality is that a significant percentage of people engaging with this curriculum are not operating in a good faith environment.
So what happens when a vulnerable partner follows this curriculum's instructions to, you know, simply state their hurt? Why is that actively dangerous?
Because in an abusive, coercive, or severely high conflict dynamic, information is ammunition.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Right. If a vulnerable partner is instructed by this course to write down exactly what hurts them, like their deepest insecurities, their fears, their pain points, an abusive partner does not view that journal entry as an invitation for intimacy.
They view it as a weapon.
Exactly. They view it as a blueprint for how to inflict future pain. They view it as a trigger to escalate their dominance. Transparency in the presence of a predator just makes you an easier target.
That makes total sense, but I know the material does mention setting boundaries briefly later in the text. Doesn't that sort of cover it?
It really doesn't, because it fails to distinguish between normal marital friction and toxic behavior. Look at the examples the text uses. Leaving a party late is an annoyance. It's a communication breakdown.
Right, just normal stuff.
Exactly. But the curriculum treats all anger as a mechanism with a purpose that the other partner needs to absorb and understand. If a vulnerable partner is told they must sit there and absorb the unchecked, explosive anger of a partner because, you know, anger has a purpose, the curriculum is inadvertently asking them to stay in the line of fire.
Yeah, we are putting them in harm's way under the guise of relationship building.
Precisely.
So, I mean, we need to build in psychological seatbelts before we ask the reader to drive at highway speeds. How do we actually fix this? What's the suggestion for the author to implement these guardrails without ruining that warm, pastoral, accessible tone? Because if you just turn this into a clinical psychology manual, you completely lose the audience.
Right. No one wants to read a textbook. So the intervention here is to introduce a preliminary safety filter or disclaimer before deploying any of the vulnerability exercises.
Okay.
The text must explicitly define the difference between safe conflict and unsafe dynamics, offering alternative pathways or off-ramps for those who might realize, maybe for the very first time while reading this book, that their relationship is currently unsafe.
So a key theme running through this material seems to be radical transparency, but we need to empower the reader to pause if transparency equals danger.
Exactly.
Let's get concrete with this. If I'm the author, where exactly am I placing this filter and what does it look like?
So our first concrete example is adding a specific pause and reflect box directly before the identifying unresolved hurt journal exercise. Visually, it should stand out from the rest of the text.
Like lightly shaded or bordered or something?
Yeah, exactly. And it needs to be compassionate, but incredibly direct. It should explicitly state something like, if your partner's anger involves physical intimidation, name-calling, coercive control, or if you feel a chronic sense of fear in your home, do not use this exercise to confront them alone. Seek support from a licensed professional or a local support hotline before proceeding.
I like that because it's highly actionable. And it doesn't disrupt the flow for the couples who are safe. They'll just read it, nod, and move on to the journaling. But it acts as this crucial stop sign for those who aren't.
Exactly.
Let's look closely at another section, the part discussing the rhino archetype, because there is a very specific anecdote in the source material that warrants our attention.
Yes. The apple-throwing incident.
Yes. So, in the source material, the speaker shares a personal story about becoming so angry that she picked up an apple from a fruit basket and hurled it at her husband. And then she proceeded to systematically throw the entire pyramid of apples at him, throwing them so hard he literally had to duck behind the sofa to escape injury.
Right.
And it's presented with this lighthearted, almost self-deprecating tone, like just a classic rhino losing their temper. And I can see why an author would include this. It shows they're human, they make mistakes too.
And that relatable tone is exactly what makes it so insidious if we aren't careful. Our second concrete example for improvement involves fundamentally reframing this exact rhino description. We have to clarify the line between expressive anger and verbal or physical abuse.
What happens if we don't reframe it?
Well, imagine reading this from the perspective of someone whose partner regularly throws things at them. If they read this apple-throwing anecdote framed merely as quirky rhino behavior that requires a calm conversation later, they are going to normalize their own victimization.
Oh, man. Yeah.
They're going to read that and think, oh, my husband isn't abusive when he throws dinner plates at the wall. He's just a rhino. The author throws apples. My husband throws plates. It's just how rhinos communicate.
That is a chilling realization. By trying to be relatable, the author accidentally provides cover for domestic violence.
Exactly. So the text must state clearly that throwing objects, even fruit, or shouting aggressively, blocking doorways, or making threats crosses a definitive line. It moves from a personality archetype into unacceptable behavior that requires professional intervention, not just a calm conversation.
Right.
The curriculum should use that apple story not as a humorous confession, but as a profound teaching moment. The author should say, even in our own marriage, we crossed a line here, and we had to recognize that physical intimidation is never, ever an acceptable expression of hurt.
That elevates the text from just being a nice story to establishing a firm boundary. Let's provide a third concrete example for this section, like an actionable exercise the couples can actually do this week to establish that baseline of safety.
We need to introduce a timeout protocol as a mandatory prerequisite to the entire three-step healing process.
Okay, how does that function in practice? Is it just like walking away when you're mad? Because sometimes that just feels like abandonment.
Right, and that's why it has to be highly structured to prevent it from feeling like abandonment. We teach couples that either partner has the unilateral right to call a non-negotiable 20-minute timeout if they feel emotionally or physically unsafe or even just physiologically overwhelmed.
Okay.
But the critical rule is that the person calling the timeout must state when they will return. So they have to say, I am overwhelmed. I am taking a timeout. I will be back in exactly 20 minutes to finish this. And during that time, they separate entirely.
Why 20 minutes specifically? Why not, 5 minutes or an hour?
Because we are dealing with biological mechanics here, it takes roughly 20 to 30 minutes for the adrenal system to process and flush the cortisol and adrenaline spikes associated with severe anger.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, when you get triggered, your amygdala, the threat detection center of your brain, basically hijacks your prefrontal cortex, which is responsible for logic, empathy, and rational thought. So if you try to clear the drain while those chemicals are actively flooding the brain, you aren't communicating.
You're just colliding.
Exactly. Ensuring the environment is chemically and emotionally de-escalated is a biological necessity before any vulnerability is even attempted.
That is a brilliant physiological safeguard, because it takes the shame out of needing a break. You know, it's just biology. Now, once that safety is established and a couple effectively de-escalates, the material moves them toward communication and eventually the concept of forgiveness, which logically leads us to explore what happens after an apology is given and accepted, particularly in cases of severe betrayal.
Which is where so many couples get entirely stuck.
Right. So the powerful metaphor of entirely discarding the record of wrongs inadvertently conflates the internal moral act of forgiveness with the relational evidence-based process of restoring trust.
This is perhaps one of the most intellectually fascinating and practically challenging areas of the curriculum, because the way we talk about forgiveness in relational literature often causes immense psychological damage without meaning to.
Let me summarize how the source presents this, just to ensure accurate representation. The material offers this highly evocative analogy. It asks the reader to imagine marriage as a notebook. Every day, we might write down a list of the things our partner does that are less than loving.
Right.
And the text argues that true forgiveness, rooted in the philosophical idea that love keeps no record of wrongs, means literally tearing off each page with whatever is written on it, throwing it away, and starting each day with a completely blank slate.
It's a beautiful, poetic ideal. I wonder, though, if we fully considered how this might be weaponized in cases of serious trust violations.
Well, I want to challenge this a bit, because isn't letting go the whole point? If you hold onto the notebook, aren't you just harboring resentment? I mean, if I forgive my partner for lying, but I keep bringing it up, I haven't really forgiven them, have I?
That is the exact conflation the curriculum makes, and it's exactly where the weakness lies. Advising a hurt partner to literally throw away the record of a major betrayal, like a 10-year hidden gambling addiction, chronic deception, or an affair, it ignores the absolute necessity of protective guardrails.
How so?
It confuses the absence of vengeance with the presence of trust. While the material does briefly acknowledge later that trust takes time to rebuild, the overwhelming thrust and emotional weight of the text pushes for this clean, torn-out page. And if you are a victim of a severe violation, that metaphor applies immense pressure on you.
Right, pressure to just move on.
Yes, it pressures the victim to bypass their own psychological need for verified, changed behavior from their offending partner. It essentially demands amnesia under the guise of holiness.
Amnesia under the guise of holiness. That is incredibly potent.
If my partner has been secretly emptying our bank accounts for 5 years, and I am told that a good, forgiving spouse tears up the page and starts fresh tomorrow, my brain is going to be in a state of sheer terror.
Of course.
Trust is not a magical feeling. It is a predictive algorithm in the human brain. It relies on historical data to predict future safety. If you demand that I delete the historical data, my brain cannot predict safety, and I'll just live in a state of chronic, agonizing anxiety.
Which means the suggestion for improvement here is that the curriculum needs a robust framework that fundamentally separates two distinct concepts. We must separate forgiveness, which the author beautifully describes via a C.S. Lewis quote, as an internal release of bitterness and revenge, from reconciliation and trust.
Exactly. Forgiveness is a solo project. It happens entirely inside the hurt individual. It is the conscious decision not to let bitterness consume your soul, and choosing not to exact vengeance on the person who hurt you. You can forgive someone from a distance. You can forgive someone who is no longer living.
Right, or someone who hasn't even apologized. Because forgiveness is about setting yourself free from the poison of resentment.
Yes, but reconciliation and trust, that is an interpersonal dynamic. Trust requires two people. It cannot be freely given like grace. It must be earned back through consistent, observable, and measurable actions over time. The text must explicitly teach that keeping a temporary record is sometimes a necessary, healthy boundary, rather than a failure of love.
I can see how empowering that would be for a reader who is, you know, drowning in guilt because they can't simply forget a massive betrayal. So how do we fix the text? Let's provide some concrete examples of how the author can implement this distinction without losing their central message.
Well, our first concrete example is nuancing the notebook analogy itself. We don't have to throw the analogy away. It's far too visually powerful and memorable. Instead, we adapt it to reflect reality.
Okay, how do we adapt it?
The curriculum should explain that for everyday friction, like the anecdote they used about being late leaving a party, which they ranked a 2.5 on the Richter scale of hurt, you absolutely tear that page out. You throw it away. You do not bring up the party 3 years from now during an argument about the dishes.
Right. You clear the minor blockage and let the water flow.
But if the hurt is a level 9 or 10 betrayal on that Richter scale, you do not tear the page out immediately. Instead, you leave it in the notebook, but you fold the corner over as a bookmark.
Oh, I like that.
It remains there to remind both partners of the new boundaries and the extreme transparency required until the relational trust account is fully refunded.
A bookmark of boundaries. It validates the victim's need to protect themselves while still committing to the marriage. Let's apply this to a practical scenario. Our second concrete example for improvement should show what this looks like in action for the reader.
Let's use the scenario of financial infidelity, as it's highly common but often really misunderstood. The curriculum should include a realistic case study where one partner hid massive credit card debt.
Okay.
In this scenario, the text should explain that forgiving the partner means not attacking their character, not punishing them emotionally, and not throwing the debt in their face every time they speak. That is the internal release of vengeance.
Okay, but what does keeping a record look like in that scenario that is actually healthy?
Keeping a record in a healthy, boundaried sense means implementing mandatory joint audits of the bank accounts every single Friday at 5 p.m. It means the offending partner willingly surrenders their financial privacy until trust is restored.
Ah, okay.
That isn't a lack of forgiveness. That is the architecture of rebuilding trust. The offending partner shouldn't say, "I thought you forgave me. Why are you checking my receipts?" They should say, "I know I broke trust, and I am grateful for the opportunity to prove my honesty to you today."
That makes the abstract concept of trust highly visible. It gives the offending partner a roadmap for how to actually prove their apology is real, instead of just repeating, "I'm sorry," and expecting things to go back to normal. And that leads perfectly into our third concrete example, an actionable exercise for this week.
Yes, we need to add an exercise called defining trust metrics.
Walk me through how a couple executes this, like at the kitchen table.
For any hurt that ranks an 8 or above on the curriculum's Richter scale, verbal apologies are no longer sufficient to close the loop. This exercise requires the offending partner to sit down and write out 3 specific, measurable behavioral changes they will enact this week to begin proving their trustworthiness.
Measurable is the key word there, right? Because people often say things like, "I'll try to be better," or "I'll be more attentive."
Yes, and those are terrible metrics because they are subjective. You can't measure better. A metric is, "I will leave my phone unlocked on the kitchen counter every evening," or "I will check in via text message the moment I leave the office."
Right.
It shifts the burden of proof. Normally, the victim is carrying the burden of anxiously waiting and watching to see if they will be hurt again. This exercise shifts the burden to the offender, who is now actively demonstrating safety.
The material makes a strong case for taking responsibility, and this exercise operationalizes that responsibility. Now, to seamlessly bridge the gap from the macro-level rebuilding of trust, we need to pull the lens back to the micro-level, to the immediate physiological reactions couples experience the exact moment a conflict initiates. We need to return to those accessible archetypes, the rhino and the hedgehog.
The immediate nervous system reaction.
Right. So, categorizing conflict styles strictly into explosive or withdrawn archetypes overlooks the complex physiological trauma responses that frequently hijack marital communication.
This is a profound area for modernization within the text. If we get this right, it will create massive aha moments for the readers.
So let me outline the binary presented in the curriculum right now. The text essentially divides the population in half. On one side, we have the rhinos, those whose instinct is to fight, to attack, to put their head down and charge when they feel threatened.
Yep.
On the other side, we have the hedgehogs, those who take flight, who withdraw, who curl up, and stick out their prickles to keep the attacker at a safe distance.
It's a great start, but is there a risk that focusing solely on these two extremes might overlook individuals who cope with conflict in entirely different ways due to their neurobiology or maybe past conditioning?
I mean, I initially thought this binary was pretty comprehensive. Like, fight or flight, right? That's what we are taught in basic biology. You either yell or you walk away. What are we missing here?
We are missing half of the nervous system's survival mechanisms. This binary maps perfectly to fight the rhino and flight, or active avoidance, the hedgehog. But the human nervous system has other equally powerful survival mechanisms that this curriculum ignores entirely: the fawn response and the freeze response.
Okay, let's explain those for the listener, because I think a lot of people misuse these terms. What does it actually mean when a partner fawns? I always thought fawning was just being a people pleaser, or just having a really agreeable personality. Are you saying it's an involuntary neurological response?
It is absolutely a survival response, often developed in childhood to survive volatile caregivers. Fawning is an unconscious strategy where an individual hyper-accommodates to defuse a threat.
Okay, so how does that look in an argument?
If a rhino partner is charging and yelling, the fawning partner doesn't fight back. But they also don't withdraw and withhold like a hedgehog. Instead, they frantically appease. They instantly apologize for things they didn't even do. They agree to everything, completely abandoning their own boundaries just to make the anger stop.
Wow. So they are trying to de-escalate the room by becoming whatever the angry person needs them to be. But what is the long-term cost of that?
The cost is a complete loss of self. Because they abandon their own boundaries in the moment of conflict, they quietly build up an immense reservoir of resentment over years and years. They wake up 10 years into a marriage feeling completely hollow and bitterly angry, and their partner is shocked, saying, "But we never fight. You always agreed with me."
That's heartbreaking.
It is. And the tragedy is, the curriculum currently has no mirror for this person. The fawning partner reads about the rhino and the hedgehog and thinks, "Well, I'm not explosive, and I don't give the silent treatment. I guess I'm just a really good, agreeable spouse." They don't realize their agreeableness is actually a profound trauma response that is slowly killing their authentic self.
That is a huge blind spot. And what about the freeze response? How is that mechanically different from the hedgehog? Because the curriculum describes the hedgehog as someone who gets quiet. Isn't that freezing?
This is a vital distinction, and it's all about intentionality versus biology. The curriculum describes the hedgehog as someone who chooses to bury their anger, who might intentionally withhold affection, or who develops selective hearing.
Right, it implies an active, almost stubborn choice to disengage. It's a defense mechanism they are steering. The hedgehog is actively keeping you out.
Exactly. But a true freeze response is a literal somatic shutdown. It is not a choice. It is a biological event orchestrated by the dorsal vagal nerve. When a person is deeply overwhelmed, when their nervous system registers a massive threat, their brain determines that fighting is impossible and fleeing is impossible, so it effectively plays dead to minimize damage.
Plays dead. Wow.
The person goes blank. They literally cannot process language. The language centers of their brain, Broca's area, can temporarily go offline to conserve metabolic energy for survival.
Wait, so when my partner goes completely blank, stares at the floor, and won't answer my questions during a fight, they aren't ignoring me? They aren't just being difficult?
Biologically, they might as well be on another planet. They are neurologically paralyzed in that moment. But think about how this plays out if they only have the curriculum's current tools. If a rhino is yelling at a freezing partner, and the curriculum has only taught them about hedgehogs, the rhino will look at that blank stare and misinterpret it as intentional coldness.
Oh, I see it now.
Right? They will think, "You are stonewalling me on purpose. You're just being a stubborn hedgehog. You are choosing to ignore my pain." And that misinterpretation will cause the rhino to escalate their attack, yelling louder to get a response, which only pushes the frozen partner deeper into neurological shutdown.
It's a catastrophic mismatch of translation. The rhino thinks they are fighting a hedgehog, but they are actually traumatizing a frozen partner.
By not addressing these biological realities, readers who fawn or freeze will not see themselves in the text, and their partners will continue to misinterpret their physiology as malice.
Exactly.
So, the suggestion for improvement here is that the author must broaden the behavioral model to include a trauma-informed perspective on nervous system dysregulation.
Yes, they need to introduce at least one or two more archetypes to capture fawning and freezing. They must teach couples how to recognize when a partner is physiologically flooded, rather than just assuming they are being stubborn or aggressive.
Let's look at the concrete examples for how to weave this into the text without making it read like a medical journal.
First, adding the new archetypes. The animal metaphors are very effective. They are warm and memorable, so let's keep them. I suggest introducing the chameleon to represent the fawning response.
The chameleon! I like that! They change their colors to blend into whatever the environment demands. They aren't seen as a threat.
Exactly. The text can describe the chameleon as the partner who instantly agrees with everything to avoid the rhino's charge, but who loses their true colors in the process. Then introduce the possum to describe the freezing response.
Ah, playing dead.
Right. The text can explain how the possum isn't trying to be difficult or ignoring you. Their nervous system has just initiated a total system reboot, and they need time to come back online. Playing dead is a survival tactic.
That gives vocabulary to the invisible struggles in the room. Our second concrete example involves updating the curriculum's journaling prompts to reflect this.
Right now, the Identifying Your Style journal prompt focuses mostly on behavioral outputs, like, what do you do when you are mad? We need a physiological assessment. We should add prompts that ask readers about their physical symptoms during a conflict.
What kind of questions should they ask?
Ask them. During a conflict, do you feel a massive adrenaline rush, a hot chest, and an urge to move forward? That might be rhino energy. Do you feel a frantic, desperate urge to say whatever it takes to fix the mood and make the other person smile? That might be chameleon energy.
Okay, I see.
Or do you feel a heavy, cold numbness, a brain fog, and a literal inability to make words form in your mouth? That is possum energy.
Connecting the emotional style to the somatic reality. It helps people realize they aren't crazy and they aren't uniquely broken. Their bodies are just trying to keep them safe in different ways.
Yes, it builds immense empathy. When a rhino realizes their partner is a possum, they stop yelling because they realize the yelling is causing the paralysis.
And that leads to our third concrete example, an actionable exercise for this week that relies on that somatic awareness. If we know our bodies are reacting this way, what do we do about it?
We need to incorporate a somatic grounding exercise. Before a couple even sits down to begin the difficult, vulnerable task of clearing the drain, the curriculum should instruct them to do a 2-minute co-regulation practice.
Co-regulation. Explain the mechanics of how a couple achieves that, especially if they are currently annoyed with each other.
It bypasses the logical brain and speaks directly to the nervous system. It can be very simple. It might be sitting back to back on the floor and just matching breathing patterns for 2 minutes without talking, or instead of staring face to face across a kitchen table, which the mammalian brain can easily interpret as a predatory, aggressive gaze, they take a walk side by side.
Forward movement. Side by side, why does that work better than looking at each other?
Because of bilateral stimulation, the rhythm of walking, left, right, engages both hemispheres of the brain, which helps process emotional intensity. Combined with the fact that you aren't maintaining direct eye contact, it removes the predatory threat.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, this significantly lowers the defensive spikes of the hedgehog, calms the frantic fawning of the chameleon, brings the possum back online, and dissipates the aggressive charge of the rhino. You have to regulate the body before you can reason with the mind.
That is a profoundly useful, actionable tool that fundamentally elevates the effectiveness of the entire course. It takes a good curriculum and makes it bulletproof. So, to recap the main points we've explored today. First, we discussed the absolute necessity of implementing clear safety guardrails, like the pause and reflect disclaimers and the 20-minute timeout protocol, to protect vulnerable partners from the dangers of radical transparency in toxic or abusive dynamics.
Secondly, we explored the need to modify the notebook metaphor. We must clearly separate the internal moral act of forgiveness from the evidence-based interpersonal rebuilding of trust. Specifically using tools like trust metrics for serious betrayals rather than just tearing up the page and expecting amnesia.
And third, we highlighted the importance of expanding the rhino and hedgehog binary. By introducing archetypes like the chameleon for fawning and the possum for freezing, we account for complex physiological trauma responses, moving the curriculum from a purely behavioral model to a deeply trauma-informed perspective.
And by utilizing these practical tools, the explicit disclaimers for abuse, the trust metrics, and the mandatory physiological timeouts, this material will not only help healthy couples clear their everyday drains, but it will safely triage those who are in deep, dangerous waters.
We warmly invite the creator of this material, or any listener who is actively working on similar relational curricula, to submit their revised work or new materials to us for a future critique. We'd love to see how these adjustments transform the material. So submit your revisions and let's keep building stronger resources together. Because at the end of the day, when you are staring down into the murky waters of a blocked relationship, you need to know whether you are simply pushing through debris or if you need to call in the bomb squad before you make your next move.